Well, the last time we spoke, you had recently been thrust into the limelight with your Goldberg Variations recording. Wonderful, wonderfully received by listeners, by critics, really just a real landslide. So I'm wondering, what has life been like since that?
Well, it certainly changed a tremendous amount. I think back in 2007, which is I think when we spoke, it was all real shock to me how sudden I suddenly had a lot of attention. And since then, things have progressed in terms of the number of concerts that I play and my traveling schedule. And I think that I'm learning more of a balance now on how to deal with everything. And it's becoming more normal to me, which is a relief.
Would you do anything differently in hindsight?
I think that I coped with it pretty well, all things considered. I think in retrospect, I might have not done as many different concerts as I was offered. I think that now I am more selective about my schedule. And I know what my limits are. But I think when that happened, I didn't really know what my limits were, and I hadn't really pushed myself to that extent. So I think it was really stressful because I was sort of accepting every single engagement that came along, and it meant that I was playing, lots of different repertoire and having strange travel schedules. And now I'm trying to be more conscious of how to plan things in a way that suits me and how I think and how I work.
One of the things I noticed in some of the publicity materials is that you have still stayed quite busy despite the additional demands now on your time as a performer, that you are continuing to do what is referred to as non-traditional venues. And what really fascinates me is you're playing, for example, in prisons. I'm curious to know what that's like for you and also what kind of feedback you get from the inmates when you perform in a, in a correctional facility.
Well, I've only played twice in correctional facilities, so I can't say that it's like an ongoing thing. But the most recent one, which was last fall, last year, I played in Maryland for the State Correctional Facility for Women in Maryland. And I have to say that was really one of the most moving concerts that I've ever played. It was very different than what I thought it would be like. I had been kind of nervous about how the women would respond to this, and they were just so appreciative and they were so open to the music, and it really spoke to them in a very direct and emotional way. They were really emotionally responsive, and then they had lots of questions and they were really appreciative of me coming and playing for them. And also I spoke to them and I spoke about my family, and I think that they felt like that the fact that I shared that with them was very meaningful to them. And then they talked to me about their children and their children's musical education, which was very interesting because many of them had children who were studying music. And in fact, there was a lot more knowledge of classical music than I would have expected. So I felt like I really learned something from them, as well as them getting something from me.
Do you remember what you played for them?
Yes, it was a short concert. I think I played a few Schubert impromptus and Bach's French Suite, number 5.
So let's discuss your not yet released CD. I guess by the time people hear this, it will be released. But Bach, A Strange Beauty. Now, I know the quote is from Sir Francis Bacon quote, but the title instantly reminds me of the literal meaning of the word baroque, of sort of the misshapen pearl, the sort of ornate. And I'm wondering what captured you about that quote and whether you see Bach as being representative of that kind of strangeness and misshapenness in music.
Yeah, I hadn't actually thought of that connection that you just pointed out. I thought of it simply not in terms of all Baroque music, but in terms of Bach's music in particular, which I think I think his music is beautiful because it combines a sense of symmetry and organization and logic with mistakes. I mean, not accidental mistakes, purposeful mistakes that he puts into the music, where, you know, the harmonic progression takes a turn that you did not expect. There's a chord that seems so odd. You know, there's one variation where suddenly chromaticism emerges that you wouldn't expect to have in Bach's time. And I think that there's a kind of humanity to his music, and a sort of a sense of imperfection that makes it extremely beautiful and touching and meaningful to us. And so when I heard that quote, I just thought it was so relevant to his music, and I thought it kind of, and the whole CD is a little bit of a, it's sort of a demonstration of how Bach always sort of recycles music and uses it in different ways, and that his music is never what it seems. You know, the piano in this CD is used in many different ways. Piano as part of a string ensemble, piano as a transcription from organ, which is a transcription from cantatas, you know. And so everything is kind of seen through various lenses that are unusual.
That's a great jumping off point. I did want to ask you about the choices of music on the CD, because it really is quite, although it is Bach, it is quite a variety. It's a very, it seems like a very intentional choice of contrasts. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I did think very much about the structure of the music, the progression of the music on the CD, where there is this symmetry to it, where it starts and ends with a chorale prelude. And in the center, there's an English suite, and then on either sides of that are two concerti, as well as one more chorale prelude. But I was thinking about how Bach wasn't sort of specifically thinking about instrumentation. And, you know, just the fact that I'm playing it on the piano to begin with, of course, it's not an instrument that he knew, that this modern piano is something that he wasn't aware of. And so there's that, but I think that all of the music on this CD is related to either the orchestra or to singing. So the concerti, for example, he then used them to write cantatas. So the D minor concerto is used almost directly in a cantata, where in the cantata, the piano part is played by the organ, and that's very interesting to me. And then I think that the English suite, the opening movement, the prelude, is really written in a concerto style. So it's, even though it's just a piano playing, just a keyboard, it's imitating the sound of a keyboard with string orchestra. And the chorale preludes, I think, are very interesting because they originate from cantatas, and then they were written, he wrote them for organ, and they're really incredibly personal and very... there's something about them that's very improvisatory. And then these pianists in the early mid part of the 20th century decided to transcribe them for piano. So I have three transcriptions, one by Busoni, one by Kempf, and one by Hess. And I think they're beautiful transcriptions that sort of bring it into our world of sound.
Have you done any of your own transcriptions?
I haven't yet, but I think that probably is something that I will do in the future.
Mm-hmm. I could easily see that happening. What's it like? What's the difference between playing as a soloist, you know, obviously the Goldberg Variations, it was just you, as opposed to playing with an orchestra, collaborating with other musicians on a recording with those sort of very specific kinds of requirements?
Well, this was a very unusual situation because I used the chamber orchestra from the Berlin Staatskapelle. And we used a very small ensemble. It's only 14 instruments, and decided not to use any conductor, because my idea about this music is that it should be a complete dialogue between the keyboard and the orchestra. Or it's not even a dialogue. It's, you know, five different parts speaking to each other, or six if you count the two hands of the piano. And so I wanted them to respond directly to what I was doing. And I was kind of trepidatious about working with them, because this particular orchestra, the concertmaster is a specialist in early music in period practice. And the way that I play is really kind of anti-period practice. But he was totally fascinated with what I was doing and very open. And he said that to him it sounded like Bach as played by Schumann's daughter. so we talked a lot, and I would talk to the orchestra. And that in itself was difficult because many of them didn't speak English. It's an East German orchestra. So the concertmaster grew up in East Berlin and didn't speak any English at all. But we kind of spoke the language of music to each other, and they were absolutely lovely. And we spent a lot of time just talking, and I'd play for them, and then they'd play for me, and I would stand in the middle and conduct them and then sit down. And I feel just so happy with how it came out, because I think that it really shows what my vision of those pieces is. And I think that that's really hard to achieve with an orchestra. I mean, usually you just don't have enough rehearsal time to really make that happen, unless you're playing with an orchestra that is just so open and quick to getting, you know, the soloist interpretation, which does happen, but not all the time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I noticed in listening to A Strange Beauty is that the orchestra is very nimble. And when you say there were 14 players, that actually now makes better sense to me. But they had very pianistic kinds of tapering and very pianistic kinds of phrasing. So now this is really making sense. They really did play like a piano.
Yes, because I taught them how to do that. I think it was very interesting because it was not how they thought about bowing or about phrasing. And it was hard to tell them what I meant. In fact, I did quite a lot of talking before I went to do the sessions. I talked to quite a few string players and conductors to try to do sort of research about what terms I would use to tell them what I meant. Because, you know, I've played with a lot of string players, but I never had to actually lead them. So trying to say, well, maybe this kind of bowing might help, or, you know, using this part of your bow is what I mean. I needed to find out what all that was before I went over there. So it was a real learning experience for me. And I learned a lot in the sessions because they then translated it into how they played, because every orchestra has their own way of bowing and playing. And so it was very interesting to see them say, oh, well, let's try it like this. And then that would be it. And then I learned something that you could achieve that sound by using this type of bowing. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned something a moment ago about your playing being sort of the anti-period instrument or authentic performance. I don't remember exactly the term you used, but the gist of it being that there's sort of a different school. And not everybody necessarily knows what that means. So maybe you could explain what you mean, what you perceive as being the period instrument style or movement, and what you think is the anti-period instrument style, for other than the obvious thing that you're playing a piano.
Well, I mean, I think that there are probably, you know, there are many different camps of period practice. But if you're going to make real generalizations, they tend to use very quick tempi, play quite fast. Their phrases tend to be very short, so they tend to use lots of accents and to stress the beginning of a phrase. So there's a lot of breaths. It's very breathy. It's very quick and breathy. And what I was looking for were very long, sustained lines. So I wanted the phrases to always be going to the next point, as opposed to starting and then tapering and then starting and then tapering. I wanted it to always go the opposite direction, where it would go to some destination a few measures away. And I wanted the sound to be very sustained, so that requires a very different type of bowing. You know, they tend to use bowing where it's very fast bow that gives a lot of stress to the beginning of a note. So the note doesn't have a sustained quality. It's very like that, as opposed to and sustaining through. And I like very slow tempi in general. I mean, not everything is slow, but I tend to like things to be slower. I think the parts where I do resemble people that are period players is I think that they tend to be very free. They tend to be, if you listen to, especially like Renaissance music players, they tend to have an interesting sense of pulse and of of not keeping one pulse, basically, of it sort of changing and being changeable. And so that was something that, that's something that I think I have in common with them. But I think that the main difference for them was the tempo and the phrasing.
You clearly have a very deep affinity for Johann Sebastian Bach's music. I would like to know, what is it about Bach's music that draws you in so strongly?
Well, I mean, I think that I guess there are many different levels in which that it where I'm drawn to his music. I think that part of it is that I feel that he contains everything. So you have structure, and you have detail in that structure, and you have patterns and counterpoint. I love counterpoint, you know, polyphony, independent lines, and then you have his extraordinary harmonies, which are so expressive and lead directly to jazz. And I love his choral music. I love his solo string music. I mean, there's something for every single mood or expression in his music. And I guess I just turn to it also for some kind of, I mean, for lack of a better word, spiritual sustenance. I mean, to me, his music is the closest that I get to religion, you know, because I feel that when I listen to it, it sort of takes me to a different level of thinking and being. And I feel that too when I play it. So it's sort of the two things are in harmony, playing and listening. And that's not true for me of all music. Some music I love to play, but I don't really like to listen to. And for him, he's my favorite composer both to play and to listen to.
What else do you listen to?
Well, recently I've actually not been listening to that much classical music. I've been getting much more interested in sort of expanding my horizons. And so some friends of mine who are from different genres have been suggesting music to me. And that's been really interesting to me. I've been listening to some singer-songwriters and to some jazz, blues. And then I also always have listened to early music. I've always been very interested in that, especially like, you know, Renaissance music, English virginal music, that kind of thing. And of course, Bach. But I find it really hard to listen to romantic music. I don't really go to listen to Brahms, you know, or Schumann. And yet I love to play Brahms and Schumann, but I find it too intense to listen to unless I'm in a very particular mood. I find it just too, I don't know, too emotional.
Are there other composers you connect with on the same kind of, well, maybe not the same, but a similar kind of deep personal connection as you do with Bach? Anything you've been approaching?
Yes,
that?
I mean, I think I feel very deeply about Schumann. I love playing Schumann. And I also feel, I think Schubert too. Actually, Schubert is a composer that I like to listen to as well. And I find his music just so subtle and just so deep. And I love Brahms, too. But in terms of a composer that I would listen to as much as I would play, I would say probably Schubert. And it's interesting because Schumann, who I think is probably my favorite composer other than Bach, I find it difficult to listen to because I have very particular feelings about how it should be played. And so that gets in my way when I listen to other people play it. Whereas interestingly with Bach, I'm really very open to hearing it played in many different ways. And it doesn't bother me if I hear somebody playing something in a way that I wouldn't play it. But somehow when I listen to Schumann and I hear somebody play something in a way that I wouldn't hear it, that I don't think is not in sympathy with my own thinking, I find it very difficult to hear that. And I'm not really sure why that is.
Well, we're sitting in your parents' home, surrounded by your father's beautiful artwork, and the publicity book of this new recording has a centerfold of a 14-foot painting that has you as a baby being held by your mom. And tell me why this is in here, and tell me why or how your father's artwork has influenced you as an artist, as a musician.
Well, I think for the CD booklet and I guess for the promotional materials, I decided to use some of my father's artwork because there's an interview in the booklet that I had with Alan Rusbridger, who's the editor of The Guardian in London. And in the interview, we talk about the connection between art and music. And I grew up as the daughter of an artist going to lots of museums and going to see a lot of art with my father and my mother. And especially we saw a lot of Renaissance art. And this triptych that's in the booklet, that's the 14-foot triptych, is a kind of 20th century Renaissance piece. And I think that my feelings about Bach have been very influenced by my feelings about Renaissance art, which of course predate Bach, but I'm sure that Bach was very aware of Renaissance art because it has all of that same feeling of symmetry and layering. I mean, there are lots of different, usually there are lots of different levels of detail, landscape, portrait, you know, still life, all within one painting. And I think that that's very similar to listening to something that's contrapuntal, where it's both vertical and horizontal at the same time in music. And I think that being a musician and growing up with art and thinking in a visual way has influenced how I think about music in terms of line and texture and color. And when I was growing up, my dad used to try to draw analogies between those two things for me when I was playing. You know, sometimes I'd play something at home for him and he'd say, well, he didn't hear the line in it. And, you know, in a drawing, you have the line of a figure, you know, which should run through the entire person's body. And, you know, if my father hadn't shown me that, I might not have been aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Are either of your parents musicians?
No, they're not.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So he was obviously keenly sensitive to music and musical line, even though he's not himself a musician.
Yes, and I think actually it's very interesting because I think a lot of people that are not musicians are way more musical than we think. I mean, my husband is not a musician, though he grew up in a very musical family, but he is really, I would say, one of my best listeners in that when he listens to what I'm doing, he can articulate things that he hears very clearly. And I guess that the musical jargon is not impeding him from expressing what he hears. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's even harder to hear if you're a musician. But for my father, I think that the things that he used to say, those analogies that he used to draw, made a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. I want to shift gears just a little bit and ask you about the experience of performing for a live audience versus performing in a studio. I know there are some musicians who are absolutely would prefer playing for a live audience and really dislike the process of being in a studio where it's very sterile. And some are exactly the opposite. Some people really much, Glenn Gould, I guess, was really much, much more interested in playing in a studio environment and not playing in front of people. What is that experience like for you? Do you have a preference of one over the other?
Well, I think that they're two entirely different experiences for me. And actually, I think that radio can sometimes get in the way with these with this experience in the sense that when I'm playing a concert, it is a live experience. Therefore, it's flawed because it's live, but it also has certain elements of spontaneity and magic that happen in a concert. And that's an experience that you have to be there to hear. And I find the process of being recorded at a concert for it to be aired live very disconcerting because I think that when you're listening to something in another place and you're not in the room at a live concert, it's not the same as being there. Mm-hmm. So I think if I'm performing and it's just sheerly a performance and it's not being recorded, I think that's a beautiful thing. It's very interesting and different, and you're communicating with a live audience, and their energy is feeding you, and your energy is feeding them. Whereas when I play in a studio recording, and it's to be made into a CD, I find that an experience where I'm really searching for the ultimate expression of what it is that I hear in my head. I keep on working on it. You know, I'll play a certain part over and over again until it's right. And so it's more like what my father does in that, you know, he'll spend months on one painting. You know, he's erasing and then he's doing it again and then he looks at it from a different perspective and he thinks, no, it doesn't work from that perspective. You know, when you're recording, you're thinking about the end product of what you want to get. So it's a very different process. And I find that process artistically incredibly rewarding. And I don't have any problem with the fact that it's being edited. I think the editing of it is part of the art. And my producer is as much an artist as I am. You know, I think that producers are not given the credit that they should be given. I mean, you think about the Beatles, and you know, as wonderful as they were, their producer was, you know, probably the fifth Beatle.
So what projects do you have coming up? What new things are on the horizon for you?
Well, the most immediate new project that I have is I'm doing a project with a singer-songwriter, Tift Merritt. Ooh. And that's a real departure for me and for her. In that we're doing something that was sponsored by Duke University, and we commissioned three composers to write songs for us. Brad Meldow, the jazz pianist, Patty Griffin, who's another singer-songwriter, and Philip Lasser, who's a classical composer. And then we are also, Jenny Scheinman, who's a wonderful musician, has arranged four songs for us, like from the you know, songs that date from back from the 60s and 70s. And then we're doing some Schubert and Purcell and Schumann. So we're kind of trying to draw our two worlds together. And I'm very curious to know how this is going to turn out, but it's really exciting. It really means that I have to kind of move away from any preconceptions that I have about how something should be played. I'm really curious to see how Tift is going to interpret Schubert. And we got together, and I actually improvised, which I never thought I would be able to do. But it was really exciting. I kind of felt very free. So that's the most exciting new project that I have on the horizon.
When do you expect that will be released?
Well, that's actually not a recording. It's a series of concerts.
Oh, great.
But I wouldn't be surprised. If it goes well, then I think we probably will want to record it.
Mm-hmm. And where will you be performing?
Well, we'll be down at Duke for mm-hmm. a residency there, and then we're going to perform in California at UC Davis, mm-hmm. and then in Florida at the festival in Tallahassee.
Hmm. Any more Bach recordings on the horizon that you can talk about?
Well, the next recording I'm going to do for Sony is going to be a solo piano recording, and I don't think I can say exactly what's going to be on it, but there will be Bach in it, but it won't just be Bach.
Okay. Well, Simona Dinnerstein, thank you very much for making time to speak with me, and thanks to your parents for letting us speak in their beautiful home.
Thank you.